couldn't be sure until the storm passed. Another wave struck the ship, and it shuddered.
"Weather break!"
came the shout from above.
"Where away?" cried Amos. "Dead starboard!" "Come about!"
ordered Amos, and the helmsman leaned against the tiller. Arutha strained his eyes against the stinging salt spray and saw a faint glow seem to swing about until it stood off the bow. Then it grew larger as they drove for the thinning weather. As if walking out of a dark room, they moved from gloom to light. The heavens seemed to open above them, and they could see grey skies. The waves still ran high, but Arutha sensed the weather had turned at last. He looked over his shoulder and saw the black mass of the storm as it moved away from them. Moment by moment, the combers subsided, and after the raging clamour of the storm, the sea seemed suddenly silent. The sky was quickly brightening, and Amos said,
"It's morning. I must have lost track of time. I thought it's still night."
Arutha watched the receding storm and could see it clearly outlined, a churning mass of darkness against the lighter grey of the sky above. The grey quickly turned to slate, then blue-grey as the morning sun broke through the storm. For the better part of an hour, Arutha watched the spectacle, while Amos ordered his men about their tasks, sending the night watch below and the day watch above. The storm raced eastward, leaving a choppy sea behind. Time seemed frozen as Arutha stood in awe of the scene on the horizon. A portion of the storm seemed to have stopped, between distant fingers of land. Great spouts of water spun between the boundaries of the narrow passage in the distance. It looked as if a mass of dark, boiling clouds had been trapped within that area by a supernatural force.
"The Straits of Darkness," said Amos Trask at his shoulder.
"When do we put through them?" Arutha asked quietly.
"Now,"
answered Amos. The captain turned and shouted,
"Day watch aloft! Mid-watch turn to and stand ready! Helmsman, set course due east!"
Men scrambled into the rigging, while others came from below, still haggard and showing little benefit from the few hours' sleep since they last stood watch. Arutha pulled back the hood of his cloak and felt the cold sting of the wind against his wet scalp. Amos gripped him by the arm and said,
"We could wait for weeks and not have the wind favourable again. That storm was a blessing in disguise, for it will give us a bold start through."
Arutha watched in fascination as they headed for the straits. Some freak of weather and current had created the conditions that held the straits in water-shrouded gloom all winter. In fair weather, the straits were a difficult passage, for though they appeared wide at most points, dangerous rocks were hidden just below the water in many critical places. In foul weather, they were considered impossible for most captains to negotiate. Sheets of water or flurries of snow blown down from the southernmost peaks of the grey towers tried to fall, only to be caught by blasts of wind and tossed back upward again, to try to fall once more. Water spouts suddenly erupted upward to spin madly for minutes, then dissolve into blinding cascades. Ragged bolts of lightning cracked and were followed by booming thunder as all the fury of colliding weather fronts was unleashed.
"The sea's running high," yelled Amos. "That's good. We'll have more room to clear the rocks, and we'll be through or dash to pieces in short order. If the wind holds, we'll be through before the day is done."
"What if the winds change?"
"That is not something to dwell on."
They raced forward, attacking the edge of the swirling weather inside the straits. The ship shuddered, as if reluctant once again to face foul weather. Arutha gripped the rail tightly as the ship began to buck and lurch. Amos picked his way along, avoiding the sudden wayward gusts, keeping the ship in the westerly trail of the past storm. All light disappeared. The ship was illuminated only by the dancing light of the storm lanterns, casting flickering yellow darts into murk. The distant booming of waves upon rocks reverberated from all quarters, confusing the senses. Amos shouted to Arutha,
"We'll keep to the center of the passage. If we slip to one side or the other, or get turned, we'll stave in the hole on rocks."
Arutha nodded as the captain shouted instructions to his crew. Arutha fought his way to the forward rail of the quarter deck and shouted Martin's name. The huntmaster answered from the main deck below that he was well, though waterlogged. Arutha held tight to the rail as the ship dipped low into a trough and then started to rise as it met a crest. For what seemed minutes, the ship strained upward, climbing and climbing. Then suddenly water swept over the bow and they were heading downward again. The rail became his only contact with a solid world amid a cold, wet chaos. Arutha's hands ached from the effort of hanging on. Hours passed in cacophonous fury, while Amos commanded his crew to answer every challenge of wind and tide. Occasionally the darkness was punctuated by a blinding flash of lightning, bringing every detail into sharp focus, leaving dazzling afterimages in the darkness. In a sudden lurch, the ship seemed to slip sideways, and Arutha felt his feet go out from under him as the ship heeled over. He held to the rail with all his strength, his ears deafened by a monstrous grinding. The ship righted itself, and Arutha pulled himself around to see, in the flickering glow of the storm lanterns, the tiller swinging wildly back and forth, and the helmsman slumped down upon the deck, his face darkened by blood flowing from his open mouth. Amos was desperately scrambling upright, reaching for the lashing tiller. Risking broken ribs as he seized it, he fought desperately to hang on and bring the ship back under control. Arutha half stumbled to the tiller and threw his weight against it. A long, low grinding sound came from the starboard side, and the ship shuddered.
"Turn, you motherless bitch!"
cried Amos as he heaved against the tiller, marshalling what strength he had left. Arutha felt his muscles protesting in pain as he strained against the seemingly immobile tiller. Slowly it moved, first an inch, then another. The grinding rose in volume until Arutha's ears rang from the sound of it. Suddenly the tiller swung free once more. Arutha overbalanced and went flying across the deck. He struck the hard wood and slid along the wet surface until he crashed into the bulwark, gasping as wind exploded from his lungs. A wave drenched him, and he spluttered, spitting out a lungful of seawater. Groggily, he pulled himself up and staggered back to the tiller. In the faint light, Amos's face was white from exertion, but it was set in a wide-eyed, manic expression as he laughed.
"Thought you'd gone over the side for a moment."
Arutha leaned into the tiller, and together they forced it to move once more. Amos's mad laughter rang out, and Arutha said, "What's so damn funny?
Look!"
Panting, Arutha looked where Amos indicated. In the darkness, he saw huge forms rearing up alongside the ship, blacker shapes against the blackness. Amos yelled,
"We're clearing the Great South Rocks! Pull, Prince of Crydee! Pull, if you wish to ever see dry land again!"
Arutha hauled upon the tiller, forcing the bulky ship away from the terrible stone embrace mere yards away. Again they felt the ship shudder as another low grinding sound came from below. Amos whooped,
"If this barge has a bottom when we're through, I'll be amazed!"
Arutha felt a gut-wrenching stab of panic, followed immediately by a strange exultation. He found himself seized by a nameless, almost joyous feeling as he struggled to hold the ship on course. He heard a strange sound amid the cacophony and discovered he was laughing with Amos. laughing at the fury erupting around him. There was nothing left to fear. He would endure, or he wouldn't. It didn't matter now. All he could do was give himself over to one task, keeping the ship heading past the jagged rocks. Every fiber of his being laughed in terror, in joy at being reduced to this lower level of existence, this primal state of being. Nothing existed save the need to do this one thing upon which all was wagered. Arutha entered a new state of awareness. Seconds, minutes, hours lost all meaning. He struggled with Amos to keep the ship under control, but his senses recorded everything around him in minute detail. He could feel the grain of the wood through the wet leather of his gloves. The fabric of his stockings was gathered between his toes in his water-soaked boots. The wind smelled of salt and pitch, wet wool caps and rain-drenched canvas. Every groan of timber, smack of rope against wood, and shout of men above could be clearly heard. Upon his face he felt the wind and cold touch of melting snow and seawater, and he laughed. Never had he felt so close to death, and never had he felt more alive. Muscles bunched, and he pitted himself against forces primeval and formidable. On and on they plunged, deeper and deeper into the madness of the Straits of Darkness. Arutha heard Amos as he shouted orders, orchestrating every man's move by the second. He played his ship as a master musician played a lute, sensing each vibration and sound, striving for that harmony of motion that kept the wind of dawn moving safely through perilous seas. The crew answered his every demand instantly, risking death in the treacherous rigging, for they knew their safe passage rested solely upon his skill. Then it was over. One moment they were fighting with mad strength to clear the rocks and pass through the fury of the straits. The next they were running before a stiff breeze with the darkness behind. Ahead, the sky was overcast, but the storm that had held them for days was a distant gloom upon the eastern horizon. Arutha looked at his hands, as if at things apart, and willed them to release their hold upon the tiller. Sailors caught him as he collapsed and lowered him to the deck. For a time, his senses reeled. Then he saw Amos sitting a short way off as Vasco took the tiller. Amos's face was still mirthful as he said, "We did it, boy. We're in the bitter sea." Arutha looked about. "Why is it still so dark?" Amos laughed. "It's nearly sundown. We were on that tiller for hours." Arutha began to laugh too. Never had he felt such triumph. He laughed until tears of exhaustion ran down his face, until his sides hurt. Amos half crawled to his side. "You know what it is to laugh at death, Arutha. You'll never be the same man again." Arutha caught his breath. "I thought you mad there for a time." Amos took a wineskin a sailor handed him and drew a deep drink. He passed it to Arutha and said, "Aye, as you were. It is something only a few know in their lives. It is a vision of something so clear, so true, it can only be a madness. You see what life is worth, and you know what death means." Arutha looked up at the sailor standing by them, and saw it was the man Amos had pitched over the rail to head off the mutiny. Vasco threw the man a frown as he watched, but the man didn't move. Amos looked up at him, and the seaman said, "Captain, I just wanted to say, I was wrong. 13 years a sailor, and I'd have wagered my soul to limbs Cragmer no master could pilot a ship such as this through the straits." Lowering his eyes, he said, "I'd willingly stand for flogging for what I'd done, Captain, but after, I'd sail to the 7 lower hells with you, and so would any man here." Barutha looked about and saw other sailors gathering upon the quarter-deck or looking down from the rigging. Shouts of, "Aye, Captain," and "He has the truth of it," could be heard. Amos pulled himself up, gripping the rail of the ship, his legs wobbling a little. He surveyed the men gathered around, then shouted,
"Night watch above! Mid watch and day watch, stand down!"
He turned to Vasco.
"Check below for damage to the hull, then open the galley. Set course for Krondor."
Arutha came awake in his cabin. Martin Longbow was sitting by his side.
"Here."
The huntmaster held out a steaming mug of broth. Arutha levered himself up on his elbow, his bruised and tired body protesting. He sipped at the hot broth. "How long was I asleep?"
"You fell asleep on deck last night, just after sundown. Or passed out, if you want the truth. It's 3 hours after sunrise."
"The weather?"
"Fair, or at least not stormy. Amos is back on deck. He thinks it might hold most of the way. The damage below is not too bad. We'll be all right if we don't have to withstand another gale. Even so, Amos says there are a few fair anchorages to be found along the Keshian coast, should the need arise."
Arutha pulled himself out of his bunk, put on his cloak, and went up on deck. Martin followed. Amos stood by the tiller, his eyes studying the way the sail held the wind. He lowered his gaze to watch as Arutha and Martin climbed the ladder to the quarter-deck. For a moment he studied the pair, as if struck by some thought or another. Then smiled as Arutha asked, "How do we fare?" Amos said,
"We've a broad reach to the winds, had it since we cleared the straits. If it holds from the northwest, we should reach Krondor quickly enough. But winds rarely do hold, so we may take a bit longer."
A lookout shouted,
"Sail ho!" "Where away?"
shouted Amos.
2 points abaft port."
Amos studied the horizon, and soon 3 tiny white specks appeared. To the lookout he shouted,
"What ships?" "Galleys, Captain."
Amos mused aloud.
"Quigan. This is a bit south for their usual patrols if they're warships, and I don't think it likely they're merchantmen."
He ordered more canvas on the yards.
"If the wind holds, we'll be past before they can close. They're fat-bottomed tubs under sail, and their rowers can't maintain speed over this distance."
Arutha watched in fascination as the ships grew on the horizon. The closest galley turned to cut them off, and after a while he could make out the hulking outline of the galley, its majestic sails above a high fore and aft deck. Arutha could see the sweep of oars, 3 banks per side, as the captain attempted a short burst of speed. But Amos was right, and soon the galley was falling away behind. As the distance between the wind of dawn and the galleys slowly increased, Arutha said,
"They were flying the Royal Quigan standard. What would Quigan war galleys be doing this far south?"
"The gods only know," said Amos. "Could be they're out looking for pirates, or they could be keeping an eye out for Keshian ships straying north. It's hard to guess. Quig treats the whole of the Bitter Sea as her pond. I'd as soon avoid finding out what they're up to as not."
The rest of the day passed uneventfully, and Arutha enjoyed a sense of respite after the dangers of the last few days. The night brought a clear display of stars. He spent several hours on deck, studying the bright array in the heavens. Martin came on deck and found him looking upward. Arutha heard the arrival of the huntmaster and said, "Culgan and Tully say the stars are suns much like our own, made small by vast distances." Martin said,
"An incredible thought, but I think they are right."
Have you wondered if one of those is where the Surani homeworld lies? Martin leaned upon the rail.
Many times, Highness. In the hills you can see the stars like this, after the campfires are out. Undimmed by lights from town or keep, they blaze across the sky. I also have wondered if one of them might be where our enemies live. Charles has told me their sun is brighter than ours, and their world hotter.
It seems impossible. To make war across such a void defies all logic. They stood quietly together, watching the glory of the night, ignoring the bite of the crisp wind that carried them to Krondor. Footfalls behind caused them to turn as one, and Amos Trask appeared. He hesitated a moment, studying the two faces before him, then joined them at the rail.
"Stargazing, is it?"
The others said nothing, and Trask watched the wake of the ship, then the sky.
"There is no place like the sea, gentlemen. Those who live on land all their lives can never truly understand. The sea is basic, sometimes cruel, sometimes gentle, and never predictable. But it is nights like this that make me thankful the gods allowed me to be a sailor."
Arutha said, "And something of a philosopher as well." Amos chuckled.
"Take any deep water sailor who's faced death at sea as many times as I have, and scratch him lightly. Underneath you'll find a philosopher, Highness. No fancy words, I'll warrant you, but a deep abiding sense of his place in the world. The oldest known sailor's prayer is to Ishap. Ishap, thy sea is great and my boat is small. Have mercy on me. That sums it up."
Martin spoke quietly, almost to himself. "When I was a boy, among the great trees, I knew such things. To stand by a bowl so ancient it is older than the oldest living memory of man gives such a sense of place in the world." Arutha stretched. "It is late. I shall bid you both a good night." As he started to leave, he seemed taken by some thought. "I am not given to your philosophies, but I am pleased to have shared this voyage with you both." After he was gone, Martin watched the stars for a time, then became aware Amos was studying him. He faced the seaman and said,
"You seem taken by some thought, Amos." "Aye, Master Longbow."
Leaning against the rail, he said,
"Nearly 7 full years have passed since I came to Crydee. Something has tickled my mind since first meeting you."
"What is that, Amos?"
"You're a man of mysteries, Martin. There are many things in my own life I'd not wish recounted now. But with you, it's something else."
Martin appeared indifferent to the course of conversation, but his eyes narrowed slightly.
"There's little about me not well known in Crydee." "True, but it is that little which troubles me."
"Put your mind at ease, Amos. I am the Duke's hunt master, nothing more." Quietly, Amos said,
"I think more, Martin. In my travels through the town, overseeing the rebuilding, I've met a lot of people, and in 7 years I've heard a lot of gossip about you. Some time back I put the pieces together and came up with an answer. It explains why I see your manner change, only a little but enough to notice, when you're around Arutha, and especially when you're around the princess."
Martin laughed.
"You spin an old and tired bard's tale, Amos. You think I am the poor hunter desperate for love of a young princess? You think me in love with Carline?"
Amos said,
"No, though I have no doubt you love her, as much as any brother loves his sister."
Martin had his belt knife half out when Amos's hand caught his wrist. The thick-set seaman held the hunter's wrist in a vice-like grip, and Martin could not move his arm.
"Stay your anger, Martin. I'd not like to have to pitch you over the side to cool you off."
Martin ceased his struggling against Amos and released his knife, letting it slide back into its sheath. Amos held the hunter's wrist a moment longer, then let go. After a moment, Martin said,
"She has no knowledge, nor do her brothers. Until this time, I thought only the Duke and one or two others might know. How did you learn of it?"
Amos said,
"It was not hard. People most often don't see what is right before them."
Amos turned and watched the sails above, absently checking each detail of the ship's crew as he spoke.
"I've seen the Duke's likeness in the Great Hall. Should you grow a beard like his, the resemblance would shout for the world to see. Everyone in the castle remarks how Arutha grows to resemble his mother less and father more each passing year. And I've been nagged since we first met why no one else noticed he resembles you as well. I expect they don't notice because they choose not to. It explains so much. Why you were granted special favor by the Duke in placing you with the old huntmaster, and why you were chosen huntmaster when a new one was needed. For some time now I've suspected, but tonight I was certain. When I came up from the lower deck and you both turned in the darkness, for a moment I couldn't tell which of you was which."
Martin spoke with no emotion, just a statement of fact. "It's your life should you breathe a word of it to anyone." Amos settled himself against the rail.
"I'm a bad man to threaten, Martin Longbow."
"It is a matter of honor." Amos crossed his arms over his chest.
"Lord Borick is not the first noble to father a bastard, nor will he be the last. Many are even given offices and rank. How is the Duke of Crydee's honor endangered?"
Martin gripped the rail, standing like a statue in the night. His words seemed to come from a great distance.
"Not his honor, Captain. Mine."
He faced Amos, and in the night his eyes seemed alive with inner light as they reflected the lantern hung behind the seaman. "The Duke knows of my birth, and for his own reasons chose to bring me to Crydee when I was still little more than a boy. I am sure Father Tully has been told, for he stands highest in the Duke's trust, and possibly Colgan as well.
But none of them suspect I know. They think me ignorant of my heritage."
Amos stroked his beard.
"A knotty problem, Martin. Secrets within secrets and such. Well, you have my word. From friendship, not from threat. I'll not speak to anyone of this, save by your leave. Still, if I judge Arutha right, he would sooner know as not."
"That is for me to decide, Amos. No one else. Some day perhaps I'll tell him.
Or I may not."
Amos pushed himself from the rail.
"I've much to do before I turn in, Martin, but I'll say one more thing. You've plotted a lonely course. I do not envy you your journey upon it. Good night."
"Good night." After Amos had returned to the quarterdeck, Martin watched the familiar stars in the sky. All the companions of his solitary travels through the hills of Crydee looked down upon him. The constellations shone in the night, the beast hunter and the beast hound, the dragon, the kraken, and the five jewels. He turned his attention to the sea, staring down into the blackness, lost in thoughts he had once imagined buried forever.
"Land ho!"
shouted the lookout.
"Where away?"
answered Amos.
"Dead ahead, Captain."
Arutha, Martin, and Amos left the quarterdeck and quickly made their way to the bow. As they stood waiting for land to heave into sight, Amos said,
Can you feel that trembling each time we breast a trough? It's a keelson. If I know how a ship's made, and I do, we'll need to put in at a shipyard for refitting in Krondor.
Arutha watched as the thin strip of land in the distance grew clearer in the afternoon light. While not bright, the day was relatively fair, only slightly overcast. We should have time. I'll want to return to Crydee as soon as Erland's convinced of the risk. But even if he agrees at once, it will take some time to gather the men and ships. Martin said, dryly,
And I, for one, would not care to pass the Straits of Darkness again until the weather is a bit more agreeable.
Amos said,
Man of faint heart, you've already done it the hard way. Going to the far coast in the dead of winter is only slightly suicidal.
Arutha waited in silence as the distant landfall began to resolve in detail. In less than an hour, they could clearly make out the sights of Krondor's towers rising into the air and ships at anchor in the harbor.
Well, said Amos, if you wish a state welcome, I'd better have your banner broken out and run up the mast.
Arutha held him back, saying, Wait, Amos. Do you mark that ship by the harbor's mouth? As they closed upon the harbor, Amos studied the ship in question.
She's a beastly bitch. Look at the size of her. The prince's building them a damn sight bigger than when I was last in Krondor. Three-masted and rigged for 30 or better, sail from flying jib to spanker. From the lines of her hull, she's a greyhound, no doubt. I'd not want to run up against her with less than 3 Quigan galleys. You'd need the rowers, for those oversized crossbows she mounts fore and aft would quickly make a hash of your rigging. Now we know why those Quigan galleys were so far from home. If the kingdom's bringing warships like this to the Bitter Sea, Quig's...
Mark the banner at her masthead, Amos, said Arutha. Entering the harbor, they passed near the ship. On her bow was painted her name, Royal Griffin. Amos said,
A kingdom warship, no doubt, but I've never seen one under any banner but Krondor's.
Atop the ship's highest mast, a black banner emblazoned with a golden eagle snapped in the breeze.
I thought I knew every banner seen on the Bitter Sea, but that one is new to me.
The same banner lies above the docks, Arutha, said Martin, pointing toward the distant city.
Quietly, Arutha said,
That banner has never been seen on the Bitter Sea before.
His expression turned grim as he said, Unless I say otherwise, we are Natalie's traders, nothing more.
Whose banner is that?
Asked Amos. Gripping the rail, Arutha replied,
It is the banner of the second oldest house in the kingdom. It announces that my distant cousin Guy, the Duke of Bastyra, is in Krondor.
Chapter 6. Krondor. The inn was crowded. Amos led Arutha and Martin through the common room to an empty table near the fireplace. Snatches of conversation reached Arutha's ears as they took their seats. On close inspection, the mood in the room was more restrained than it had first appeared. Arutha's thoughts raced. His plans for securing Erland's help had been crushed within minutes of reaching the harbor. Everywhere in the city were signs that Guy de Bastyra was not simply guesting in Krondor, but was now fully in control. Men of the city watch followed officers wearing the black and gold of Bastyra, and Guy's banner flew over every tower in the city. When a dowdy serving wench came, Amos ordered 3 mugs of ale, and the men waited in silence until they were brought. When the serving woman was gone, Amos said,
We'll have to pick our way carefully now.
Arutha's expression remained fixed. How long before we can sail?
Weeks. At least three. We've got to get the hull repaired, and the keelson replaced correctly. How long will depend on the shipwrights. Winter's a bad time. The fair weather traders haul out their ships so they'll be fit come spring. I'll begin inquiries first thing tomorrow.
That may be too long. If needs be, buy another. Amos raised an eyebrow.
You've funds?
In my chest aboard ship. With a grim smile, he said, the Serrani aren't the only ones who play politics with war. To many of the nobles in Krondor and the East, the war is a distant thing, hardly imaginable. It has gone on for nearly 9 years, and all they ever see is dispatches. And our loyal kingdom merchants don't donate supplies and ships out of love for King Roderick. My gold is a hedge against underwriting the cost of bringing Krondorian soldiers to Crydee, both in expenses and bribes.
Well then, said Amos. Even so, it will be a week or two. You don't usually stroll into a ship's brokerage and pay gold for the first ship offered, not if you wish to avoid notice. And most of the ships sold are fairly worthless. It will take time.
And, put in Martin, they're the straits.
That's true, agreed Amos. Though we could take a leisurely turn up the coast to Sarth and wait to time our run through the straits.
No, said Arutha. Sarth is still in the Principality. If Guy's in control of Krondor, he'll have agents and soldiers there. We won't be safe until we're out of the Bitter Sea. We'll attract less attention in Krondor than in Sarth. Strangers are not uncommon here. Amos looked long at Arutha, then said,
Now, I don't claim to know you as well as some men I've met, but I don't think you're as concerned for your own skin as something else.
Arutha glanced about the room.
We'd better find a less public place to talk.
With a sound between a sigh and a groan, Amos heaved himself out of his chair.
The Sailor's Ease is not where I'd prefer to stay, but for our purposes it will serve.
He made his way to the long bar and spoke at length to the innkeeper. The heavy-set owner of the inn pointed up the stairs, and Amos nodded. He signed for his companions to accompany him and led them through the press of the common room, up the stairs, and down a long hall to the last door. Pushing it aside, he motioned for them to enter. Inside they found a room with little to recommend itself by way of comforts. 4 straw-stuffed pallets rested on the floor. A large box in the corner served as a common closet. A crude lamp, a simple wick floating in a bowl of oil, sat upon a rude table. It burned with a pungent odor when Longbow struck a spark to it. Amos closed the door as Arutha said, I can see what you meant about choices in rooms.
I've slept in far worse, answered Amos,
settling down on one of the pallets.
If we're to keep our liberty, we'd best establish believable identities. For the time being, we'll call you Arthur. It's close enough to your own to afford a passable explanation, should someone call out your real name and cause you to turn or answer. Also, it will be easy to remember.
Arutha and Martin sat down, and Amos continued.
Arthur, get used to that name. Of navigating cities you know less than a thimbleful, which is twice as much as Martin knows. You'll do well to play the role of some minor noble's son from some out-of-the-way place. Martin, you are a hunter from the hills of Natal.
I can speak the language passing well. Arutha gave a half-smile. Get him a grey cloak and he'd make a fair ranger. I don't speak the language of Natal, or the Keshian tongue, so I'll be the son of a minor eastern noble, visiting for recreation. Few in Krondor could know half the barons of the east.
Just so long as it's not too close to Bastyra. With all those black tabards about,
It would be a pretty thing to run into a supposed cousin among Guy's officers.
Arutha's expression turned dark. You were correct about my concerns, Amos. I'll not leave Krondor until I've discovered exactly what Guy is doing here and what it means for the war.
Even should I find us a ship tomorrow, said Amos, which is unlikely, you should have plenty of time to snoop about. Probably find out more than you'll want to know. The city's a lousy place for secrets. The rumour mongers will be plying their trade in the market, and every commoner in the city will know enough to give you a fair picture of what's taken place. Just remember to keep your mouth shut and ears open. Rumour mongers will sell you what you want to know, then turn around and sell news of your asking to the city guard so fast it'd make you spin to watch.
Amos stretched, then said,
It's still early, but I think we should have a hot meal then to bed. We've a lot of prowling about to accomplish.
With that, he rose and opened the door, and the three men returned to the common room. Arutha munched upon a nearly cold meat pie. Lowering his head, he forced himself to continue consuming the pieman's greasy ware. He refused to consider what was contained within the soggy crust, in addition to the beef and pork the cellar claimed. Casting a sidelong glance across the busy square, Arutha studied the gates to Prince Erlen's palace. Finishing the pie, he quickly crossed to an ale stand and ordered a large mug to wash away the aftertaste. For the last hour he had moved, seemingly without purpose, from seller's cart to seller's cart, purchasing this and that, posing as a minor noble's son. And in that hour he had learned a great deal. Martin and Amos came into sight, nearly an hour before the appointed time. Both wore grim expressions and kept glancing nervously about. Without comment, Amos motioned for Arutha to follow as they walked by. They pushed through the midday throng and passed quickly away from the great square district. Reaching a less hospitable-looking, though no less busy area, they continued until Amos indicated they should enter a particular building. Once through the door, Arutha was met by a hot, steamy atmosphere as an attendant came to greet them.
A bathhouse? Said Arutha.
Without humor, Amos said,
You need to get rid of some road dirt, Arthur.
To the attendant, he said,
A steam for us all.
The man led them to a changing room and handed each a rough towel and a canvas bag for belongings. They undressed, wrapped the towels about them, and carried their clothing and weapons in the bags into the steam room. The large room was completely tiled, though the walls and floors were stained and showed patches of green. The air was close and fetid. A small half-naked boy squatted in the center of the room, before the bed of rocks that supplied the steam. He alternately fed wood to the huge brazier below the stones and poured water upon them, generating giant clouds of steam. When they were seated upon a bench in the farthest corner of the room, Arutha said, Why a bathhouse? Amos whispered,
Our inn has very thin walls, and a great deal of business is conducted in places such as these, so three men whispering in the corner won't draw undue attention.
He shouted to the boy,
You lad, run and fetch some chilled wine.
Amos tossed a silver coin at the boy, who caught it in mid-air. When he didn't move, Amos tossed him another, and the boy scampered off. With a sigh, Amos said,
The price of chilled wine has doubled since I was last here. You'll be gone for a while, but not too long.
What is this?
Asked Arutha, not taking pains to hide his ill humour. The towel itched and the room stank, and he doubted if he'd be any cleaner for the time spent here than if he'd stayed in the square.
Martin and I both have troublesome news.
As do I. I already know Guy is viceroy in Krondor. What else have you learned? Martin said, I overheard some conversation that makes me believe Guy has imprisoned Erland and his family in the palace.
Arutha's eyes narrowed, and his voice was low and angry.
Even Guy wouldn't dare harm the Prince of Krondor.
Martin said, He would, should the king give his leave. I know little of this trouble between the king and the prince, but it is clear Guy is now the power in Krondor and acts with the king's permission, if not his blessing.
You told me of Caldric's warning when you were last in Rillanon. Perhaps the king's sickness has grown worse.
Madness, if you mean to speak clearly, snapped Arutha.
To further cloud things in Krondor, said Amos, it seems we are at war with Great Kesh.
What? Said Arutha.
A rumor, nothing more.
Amos spoke quietly and quickly.
Before finding Martin, I was nosing around a local joy house, not too far from the garrison barracks. I overheard some soldiers at their ease saying they were to leave at first light for a campaign. When the object of one soldier's momentary ardor asked when she would see him again, he said, As long as it takes to march to the Vale and back, should luck be with us. At which point he invoked Ruthia's name, so that the Lady of Luck would not view his discussion of her province disfavorably.
The Vale? Said Arutha. That can only mean a campaign down into the Vale of Dreams. Kesh must have hit the garrison at Shamata with an expeditionary force of dog soldiers. He's no fool. He'll know the only answer's a quick, unhesitating strike from Krondor to show Great Kesh's Empress we can still defend our borders. Once the dog soldiers have been driven south of the Vale, we'll have another round of useless treaty talks over who has the right to it. That means even should Guy wish to aid Crydy, which I doubt, he could not. There's no time to deal with Kesh, return, and reach Crydy by spring, or even early summer.
Arutha swore.
This is bitter news, Amos.
There is still more. Earlier today, I took the trouble to visit the ship, just to ensure Vasco had everything in hand, and that the men weren't chafing too much at being kept aboard. Our ship is being watched.
Are you sure?
Certain. There's a couple of boys who stand around, playing at net-mending, but they do no real work. They watch closely as I rode out and back.
Who do you think they are?
I can't begin to guess. They could be Guy's men, or men still loyal to Erland. They could be agents of Great Kesh, smugglers, even mockers.
Mockers? Asked Martin. The Guild of Thieves, said Arutha. Little goes on in Krondor without notice by their leader, the upright man. Amos said,
That mysterious personage runs the mockers with tighter control than a captain has over his crew. There are places in the city where even the prince cannot reach, but no place in Krondor is beyond the upright man. If he's taken an interest in us, for whatever reason, we have much to fear.
The conversation was interrupted by the serving boy's return. He set down a chilled pewter pitcher of wine and three cups. Amos said,
Fetch yourself to the nearest incense vendor, boy. This place stinks. Buy something sweet to toss upon the fire.
The boy regarded them a little warily, then shrugged as Amos tossed him another coin. He ran from the room, and Amos said,
You'll be back soon, and I've run out of reasons to send him away. In any event, this place will soon be thick with merchants taking an afternoon steam. When the boy comes back, sip some wine. Try to relax, and don't leave too soon. Now, in all this bleak mess, there is one small glimmer of light.
Then I would hear what it is, said Arutha.
Guy will soon be gone from the city.
Arutha's eyes narrowed. Still, his men will be left in charge. But what you say does have some aspect of comfort.
There are few in Krondor likely to mark me by sight, for it's nearly 9 years since I was last here, and most of those have likely disappeared with the prince. Also, there is a plan I've been considering. With Guy out of Krondor, I would have an even better chance of success.
What plan?
Asked Amos. I'll tell you when I've had more time to dwell upon it. Where could we safely meet? Amos considered.
Brothels, drug houses, and gambling halls are all as bad as inns. Either the mockers control them and note everyone coming and going, or there are others about looking for information to sell. If someone overheard you speaking the wrong phrase, the mockers or the city guards could be down on you in minutes.
He was quiet for a moment. Then he smiled.
I have the very place. When the town watch rings the hour bell, 2 hours after sunset, meet me at the east end of Temple Square.
The boy returned and tossed a small bundle of incense upon the fire, cutting off conversation. Arutha settled back and drank the chilled wine, rapidly warming in the heat of the steam room. He closed his eyes, but was not relaxing as he considered the situation. After a while, he began to feel his plan might work if he could reach Dulanik. Running out of patience, he was the first to rise, rinse off, dress, and leave. Arutha waited as Martin and Amos approached from different parts of the city, crossing Temple Square. On all sides, the temples of the greater and lesser gods rose up. Several were busy with pilgrims and worshippers entering and leaving, while others were nearly deserted. Reaching the prince, Amos said,
How fared you this afternoon?
Arutha spoke softly. I occupied my time in a tavern, keeping to myself. I did overhear some conversation about Erland, but when I tried to get closer, the speakers moved off. Otherwise, I considered the plan I spoke of. Martin glanced about, then said,
An ill-omened place you picked, Amos. Gathered at this end of the square are all the gods and goddesses of darkness and chaos. Amos shrugged. Which means few travellers nearby after nightfall, and a clear view of anyone approaching.
To Arutha he said,
Now, what is this plan?
Quietly and quickly, Arutha said, I noticed two things this morning. Erland's personal guards still patrol the palace grounds, so there must be limits to Guy's control. Second, several of Erland's courtiers entered and left freely enough, so some large portion of the daily business of governing the Western realm must remain unchanged. Amos stroked his chin, thinking.
That would seem logical. Guy brought his army with him, not his administrators. They're still back-running Bastyra.
Which means Lord Dulanik and others not entirely sympathetic to Guy might still be able to aid us. If Dulanik will help, I can still succeed with my mission.
How?
Asked Amos. As Erland's Knight Marshal, Dulanik has control of vassal garrisons to Krondor. Upon his signature alone, he could call up the garrisons at Durrani's Vale and Malak's Cross. If he ordered them to march to Sarth, they could join the garrison there and take ship for Crydee. It would be a hard march, but we could still bring them to Crydee by spring.
And no hardship to your father either. I was going to tell you, I have heard Guy has sent soldiers from the Krondorian garrison to your father.
Arutha said, That seems strange. I can't imagine Guy wishing to aid father. Amos shook his head.
Not so strange. To your father, it will seem as if Guy has been sent by the king only to aid Erland. For I suspect the rumours of Erland's being a prisoner in his own palace are not as yet widespread. Also, it is a fine pretext to rid the city of officers and men loyal to the prince. Still, it is no small boon to your father. From all accounts, nearly 4,000 men have left or are leaving for the north. That might be enough to deal with the Surani, should they come against the Duke.
Martin said,
But should they come against Kreide? For that, we must seek aid. We must get inside the palace and find Dulanic.
How?
Amos asked. It was my hope you might have a suggestion. Amos looked down, then said,
Is there anyone in the palace you know to be trustworthy?
Before, I could have named a dozen, but this business makes me doubt everyone. Who stands with the viceroy and who with the prince, I can't begin to guess.
Then we'll have to nose about some more, and we'll have to listen for news of likely ships for transport. Once we've hired a few, we'll slip them out of Krondor one or two at a time, every few days. We'll need at least a score to carry the men of three garrisons. Assuming you get Dulanic's support, which brings us back to gaining entrance to the palace.
Amos swore softly.
Are you sure you wouldn't care to chuck this business and become a privateer?
Arutha's expression clearly showed he was unamused. Amos sighed.
I thought not.
Arutha said, You seem to know the underside of the city well, Amos. Use your experience to find us a way into the palace, even if through the sewer. I'll keep my eyes open for any of Erland's men who might wander through the great square. Martin, you'll have to simply keep your ears open. With a long sigh of resignation, Amos said,
Getting into the palace is a risky plan, and I don't mind telling you I don't care for the odds.
He hiked his thumb at a nearby temple.
I may even bounce into Ruthia's temple and ask the Lady of Luck to smile upon us.
Arutha dug a gold coin from his purse and tossed it to Amos. Say a prayer to the lady for me as well. I'll see you back at the tavern later. Arutha strode off into the gloom, and Amos inclined his head toward the temple of the Goddess of Luck.
Care to make a votive offering, Martin?
The night's silence was ruptured by trumpets calling men to arms. Arutha was the first to the window, thrusting aside the wooden shutters and peering through. With most of the city asleep, there were few lights to mask the glow in the east. Amos reached Arutha's side, Martin a step behind. Martin said, Campfires, hundreds of them. The huntmaster glanced heavenward, marking the stars' positions in the clear sky, and said,
2 hours to dawn.
Guy's readying his army for the march, said Arutha quietly. Amos leaned far out the window. By craning his neck, he could catch a glimpse of the harbor. In the distance, men were calling aboard ships.
Sounds like they're readying ships as well.
Arutha leaned with both hands upon the table by the window. Guy will send his foot soldiers by ship down the coast, into the Sea of Dreams, to Shamata, while his cavalry rides to the south. His foot will reach the city fresh enough to help bolster the defense, and when his horses arrive, they aren't sick from traveling by ship, and they'll arrive within days of one another. As if to prove his words, from the east came the sounds of marching men. Then a few minutes later, the first company of Bas Tyra's foot soldiers came into view. Arutha and his companions watched them march past the open gate of the inn's courtyard. Lanterns gave the soldiers a strange, otherworld appearance as they marched in columns down the street. They stepped in cadence, their golden eagle banners snapping above their heads. Martin said, They are well-schooled troops. Arutha said, Guy is many things, most of them unpleasant, but one thing cannot be argued. He is the finest general in the kingdom. Even father is forced to admit that, though he'll say nothing else good about the man. Were I the king, I would send the armies of the east under his command to fight the Serrani. 3 times Guy has marched against Kesh, and 3 times he has thrashed them. If the Keshians do not know he's come west, the very sight of his banner in the field may drive them to the peace table, for they fear and respect him.
Arutha's voice became thoughtful in tone.
There is one thing. When Guy first came to be Duke of Bastyra, he suffered some sort of personal dishonor. Father never told what that shame was, and took to wearing only black as a badge of sorts, earning him the name Black Guy. That type of thing takes a strange brand of personal courage. Whatever else can be said of Black Guy de Bastyra, none will call him craven.
While the soldiers continued to pass below, Arutha and his companions watched in silence. Then, with the sun rising in the east, the last soldiers disappeared along the streets to the harbor. The morning after Guy's army had marched, it was announced the city was sealed, the gates closed to all travelers and the harbor blockaded. Arutha judged it a normal practice to prevent Kheshin agents from leaving the city by fast sloop or fast horse to carry word of Guy's march. Amos used a visit to the Wind of Dawn to view the harbor blockade and discovered it was a light one, for Guy had ordered most of the fleet to stand off the coast at sea ambush, watching for any Kheshin flotillas, should Kesh learn the city was stripped of her garrison. The city was now policed by city guards in Guy's